You are listening to CFRO Community Radio Station. The upcoming show, Conscious Living Radio, is a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation.
Hey, you!
Your life is yours to create.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Tasha Sims.
And I'm Mark Caron.
And you're listening to Conscious Living, Co-op Radio 100.5 FM on Wednesday night, 6 to 7. Of course, we're streaming live right now. And then the show's available as a podcast after it airs on radio. And that's at www.consciousLivingRadio.org. So today we're speaking with Travis Lupik. He's an award-winning journalist who's written for the LA Times, Vice Magazine, Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, among others. And his first book, Fighting for Space, How a Group of Drug Users Transformed One City's Struggle with Addiction, was based on Vancouver. It was a fascinating read. He looked at the drug epidemic and the introduction of fentanyl, really began this rethinking of the war on drugs. And his latest book continues with a focus also on harm reduction solutions. And it's told through the eyes of two women activists who are working on the front lines to reduce overdose deaths. This book is called Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival. Welcome to the show, Travis.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for that wonderful intro.
So powerful book. I mean, it's not your typical story of despair and darkness, because it really, not only does it explore addiction and demand that addicts have the same rights as anybody else, but it really introduces us to a couple of remarkable women. I want to start personally. What drew you to write this book?
It very much, you know, these two women live in the United States, and then Light Up the Night takes place in the context of the overdose crisis in the United States. But this all came from Vancouver, and it came from Fighting for Space. My first book recounts Vancouver's history with harm reduction, primarily the establishment of the continent's first supervised injection facility, InSight, which opened on East Hastings Street in 2003. And that's the story I told in Light Up the Night. And then, even though the setting is different, Light Up the Night kind of continues that story from Fighting for Space, kind of picking up where those harm reduction heroes, if you will, sort of left off. The United States, most jurisdictions are quite a few years behind Vancouver and Canada on harm reduction, things like needle exchange, fentanyl test strips, even methadone and opiate substitution treatment and that sort of thing. So in telling this history of harm reduction, a lot of Fighting for Space covered in late 1980s right up to the present, and then Light Up the Night is entirely in the present. We're talking about how people are surviving with, as you mentioned, fentanyl, even more dangerous substances like carfentanil, and that's where I met these two amazing activists.
Why Light Up the Night? What was it about that? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I won't. I won't give away the climax of the book, which is where that title comes from. But thematically, it's about, you know, bringing back to life so many people who have passed away in this overdose crisis. You know, lighting candles in a march through the streets, remembering those that we've lost, for example, bringing them back for that period of the march.
Mm-hmm. And you felt it was really important. I mean, this field has been talked about for a long time, but not necessarily including drug users, right? Who in your book, that's prevalent, that how important that is. So maybe you can touch on that. Why do you think it's so important that the people themselves who are using are involved in the solutions and creating the solutions?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. I mean, that's like my favorite question, because I think that's what makes this book stand out. I've read a lot of books written about this overdose crisis, and I've written a lot of addiction memoirs. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of books about this crisis, probably all of them. And every single one, and every single one of these memoirs I've read, they're all told through the eyes of a politician or a former police officer who's now against the war on drugs, or the parent of someone, you know, the parent mm-hmm. of someone who passed away of a drug overdose. Many of them are written by former people who use drugs who have been in recovery for a number of years, so sort of looking back. Light Up the Night is not a recovery memoir. This is not a self-help guide. This is a book told through the eyes of people who use hard drugs today and are surviving this overdose crisis, this fentanyl crisis. And I think that amazingly is a voice that even up till today has been largely entirely left out of conversations around drug policy reform, and especially how to respond to this fentanyl crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at panels in Washington, D.C. or in Ottawa, and they're, you know, politicians and, again, police officers, a lot of law enforcement, maybe healthcare professionals. But there's never, you know, people who actually use drugs who are actually dying in this crisis that are sitting on those panels talking about how to respond. And so I hope what Light Up the Night really does is take that voice, unapologetically pushes it out there, and amplifies it for a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many misconceptions. I'm wondering if we can do a bit of an overview. And I know there are different opinions as well about the root cause, and just the whole approach to addiction is so varied. Let's see if we can correct some misconceptions, at least from your perspective. So what do you think is one of the most common misunderstandings around addiction and its cause?
That people are having a good time. You know, that people got into cocaine or heroin because they were partying too much, and that they've continued with that lifestyle because they enjoy it. And, you know, they just don't want to leave it. That's why they don't go to treatment, because, you know, they just don't want to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. You know, how so many people say. And that's not the case. How I can explain my views on addiction and misconceptions around addiction are by recounting how my eyes were opened. This was 2009, and I found a book by Dr. Gabor Mate, a prominent Vancouver resident, mm-hmm. Called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. And this was Gabor's memoir of working in the downtown East Side for 10, 15 years, helping treat addiction and mental health problems in that neighborhood, you know, right in the thick of it along East Hastings. I didn't know anything about addiction before Hungry Ghosts. And I sort of bought into a lot of those stereotypes. You know, I thought that a lot of people were doing drugs for a good time. And reading Hungry Ghosts just, it was one of those books, you know, that just kind of like shifts your entire focus mm-hmm. on the world, and just like mm-hmm. opens up a whole different way of looking at everything. You know, he talks about how every female patient, you know, he says, I'm not exaggerating, every female patient has suffered sexual or physical abuse that I saw for 10 years. And those are the people who are doing heroin. Those are the people who are addicted to heroin. They found heroin to self-medicate, because our society has chosen not to prioritize mental health care or a response to trauma. You know, we blame people for using drugs, but we don't give them any real tools mm-hmm. or any sort of capable system to deal with past trauma and mental health issues, not really. Mm-hmm. And so Gabor's book started to build this picture in my head, you know, women especially, but men too, you know, have been abused as children. Later in life, they're self-medicating with drugs like heroin just to do whatever they can to push those memories away and deal with society. And our response is to harass them with police and throw them in jail.
Right.
It just became this picture of, you know, victimizing victims in such terrible circumstances. And we're just, you know, we're chasing them down alleys and we're throwing them in jail and forcing them into withdrawal and forcing them to bear these memories that cause them so much pain alone in a jail cell. It shifted how I look at addiction yeah. and everybody yeah. who use drugs, that these are not people who are partying and having a good time. So often they're just struggling with the society that we, you know, haven't built for everybody.
He actually did what's it called? Not a testimonial. What's it called? Endorsement of your book.
He wrote a blurb on the back of the book.
Yeah. He said, he calls your book a true antidote to the insanity of the drug war and to punitive approaches to human suffering. And that's what you're talking about. How do you, somebody's suffered, somebody's had a horrific childhood, somebody's brain is literally wired you know, in a certain way based on what happened to them, and we're going to punish them. So it's as you said, it's we're victimizing the victim in our approach. And so is it safe to say that for you, that's a big driver to open people's eyes to that, so things can legally change as well as our perception and the stigma?
Yeah, entirely. And I put a strong emphasis on that in Light Up the Night. Our two main characters are the real live women, Jess Tilley in Massachusetts and Louise Vincent in North Carolina. And they're both people who through most of their lives now have used heroin. You know, they've gone through treatment and then spent long periods on methadone too, but they've also had to rely on heroin to self-medicate. Because Jess Tilley suffered abuse when she was a child and a teenager, and Louise Vincent has really struggled with mental illness and fitting into this world. And so they've used drugs because for them, that's worked as a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. They've also worked incredibly, they also work incredibly hard and are incredibly productive people who are organizing a national movement and getting people together and having a say in policy. So that's another misconception too, that, you know, people who use drugs don't accomplish anything and just sit on street corners. Right. It's one of the primary reasons that I got together with these women, because they have direct experience in this misconception that we're talking about. You know, these mm-hmm. are two people who struggled in their past and who did spend much of their life self-medicating because our system truly failed them.
Yeah, I think one of your chapters is called Trauma is My Gateway, was my gateway drug.
Right. That was Jess Tilley. Yeah. Who says, trauma was my gateway drug. You know, she didn't start using heroin because she liked smoking cannabis. She started using heroin because she struggled with abuse in her past, and that was her gateway drug.
So let's talk about teenagers for a second, because I know there's a lot of parents who really, it's their worst nightmare. We know teens experiment. That's part of the human development of what you're discovering who you are in relation, like, I'm not my family. It's the time where you go, right, I am not that, so who am I? And so there's experimenting, and then there's this idea, and certainly there has been for a long time, that the appropriate response is tough love to a teen who's experimenting with drugs. And so tons of teenagers were sent to these boot camps. And I know your book talks about how horrific some of these places were, and again, re-traumatized some of the teens. But I wonder if you have some insight into, you know, talking to the parent and going, how can you tell the difference between a teen who's experimenting and one who is suffering and actually needs, and then I guess I want to lead to what kind of support would be helpful.
Yeah, let's take a deep breath. That's probably the toughest question I'm ever asked. Mm-hmm. And let's start there. I mean, let's admit and let's acknowledge that this is complicated and really difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're the parent of a teenager who starts to get heavy into drugs when they're too young, you know, that is a really tough situation, and there is no perfect response. There's no silver bullet for that one. But we do have some research and scientific information now about what doesn't work. You know, we're starting to sort of helpfully lead ourselves to a solution by process of elimination. And one of the things that I found through Louise's story that doesn't work and has a lot of scientific research saying it doesn't work is these boot camps. You know, the sort of thing that you kind of saw on daytime television in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I think actually Paris Hilton just put out a reality series about her experience in boot camp or something. Louise was sent to one of these camps when she was a teenager. She was sent all the way from North Carolina to Utah. And she was dumped on a farm. And, you know, she slept in a sleeping bag out in a barn for a couple of weeks and did hikes to nowhere throughout the day. And nobody there had any medical training about how to respond to addiction or anything like that. And through this entire experience, Louise didn't feel like she was getting better and like she had fewer reasons to do drugs. She felt alone and she felt abandoned. And that isolated her and I think probably led her to use more drugs. Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of tough love just not working.
And especially,
I understand, like, the intentions are so good, right? And so, you know, I don't want to be too hard on it, because of course we all just want our children to thrive and drug use can interfere with that. but tough love, you know, kicking them out, just grounding them forever. These things can really isolate someone who might be using drugs because they feel isolated.
And isn't it true that part of the definition of an addiction is it's resistant to negative outcomes, right?
So, right. Yeah. When you look this thing up in medical manuals, the definition of an addiction says that it does not respond to negative consequences,
right?
But our primary response is tough love, prison, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Punish.
Like by its very definition, our primary response will not work, but we continue with it.
And so the other part, and I got this when I read Dr. Mate's book, and we've interviewed him on the show as well. It's that loss, that lack of connection that he also saw and felt. And most people have experienced certainly a sense of not belonging or not being connected. And again, it's tricky because that is a part of adolescence in a way. But what is, maybe generally speaking, what is a healthy response to support a person who's feeling kind of not connected, disenfranchised?
Yeah, another one of my favorite authors on addiction is Johann Hari, who wrote a book called Chasing the Scream, The First and the Last Days of the War on Drugs. And it actually had a second subtitle when it was re-released, which was The Opposite of Addiction is Connection. I mean, that was the subtitle of the re-release of that book. And Johann draws very heavily on Gabor's work. Gabor's in his books and that sort of thing, and gives him a lot of credit for it. The opposite of addiction is connection. So if someone's feeling, you know, isolated, if they're a teenager who feels like no one understands them, and as parents, all we do is kick them out, ground them, send them to Utah for some boot camp. You're severing your connections with them. You're severing further connections. You're isolating them. This stuff gets really tricky because maybe they're stealing from you. You know, and that's something where you have to set a boundary. And there's a big difference there, I think, between tough love and boundaries. You know, swearing off of tough love.
A boundary would have a logical consequence attached to an action. Like it's clear to anyone, you do this, here's what happens as part of a boundary.
Right. Right.
Whereas tough love is like, where are you going? All of a sudden you're grabbed in the middle of the night and taken to some camp somewhere, and you don't know what, you've left your family, but you don't know what's going on, except you've been bad.
And you can set boundaries that maintain that connection. You know, you can say we're like, well, you know, if you're stealing from us, your allowance is done and anything like that. But we're still going to, you know, watch TV with you in the evenings. You know, we're still going to try and talk to you and maybe, you know, take you to a soccer game on the weekends or something. You're setting boundaries, setting limits, maybe even, you know, implementing punishments, but you're maintaining that connection.
Right. I know there's a part of your book, I'm going to read right from it. It says, the less effective our own internal chemical happiness system is, the more we're driven to seek out joy or relief through drug taking or other compulsions that we see as rewarding. So let's talk a little bit about brain chemistry if we can here, and how it's brought on both from the past, from misuse of drugs, and just, I'd love to touch on too, why some people and not others? How does one person experiment and then they kind of grow out of it or figure things out, and somebody else becomes addicted and can't cope without it? Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah. Those are big questions too. You're asking the tough ones. And this is, you know, and then this is where our response becomes so much more challenging, and, you know, why tough love can become so tempting, because everybody is different and some people are much more likely to transition from experimentation to addiction. And we're just starting to understand why, you know, and we're just starting to find evidence inside people's genes and DNA, which gives some indications. Genetics and DNA does play a role in addiction. But I would say, and this is not controversial, but highly debatable, environment plays a larger role. That connection that we're talking about plays a larger role. But there is that genetic factor that can make it more likely, you know, to make that transition. almost more than genetics, though. I kind of, you know, these are very, these are just personal views. So I'm not pretending that there's a lot of research backing some of this. But I wonder if, you know, we're looking at genetics and we're mistakenly given genetics credit for what is actually family history. You know, what happened in your parents' life and their grandparents' life and how that translated into how they treat you now as a parent. You know, there's hard data, especially in the United States, that says that you can predict a person's height by the neighborhood that they're born in, by the level of income in that neighborhood. And you know, you're not predicting a person's income based on their genes. You're predicting it based on their environment and their access to healthy food and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's something kind of similar with addiction, where family history is really playing a strong role.
Well, if we're doing opinions, I'll do mine. the emotional transmission of unfinished business in a family system, because it is a system. It's not just like every family system is completely different with different rules, different beliefs, different values. And you're born into that. And you literally, like when I do a genogram for a person, you can look back three generations and you can see what's coming down the pipe and lands on one child versus the other. Like you can find patterns that you're just stunned going, oh my God. So it's not just like, oh, alcoholics, but affairs. And it's so many specific things that are being patterns that are being passed on, addiction being another one of them. Mm-hmm. But here's the opinion part. So that's not opinion. That's systems theory, family theory. Sure. My opinion is, and this, Mark, you'll like this because it's back to our whole thing around authenticity and transparency. Most family systems have rules saying, don't talk about this or this or this. This changes from family to family, but most dysfunctional families have a presentation that they want the world to see. And then there's the real deal. And if that message is being passed on. So to the kid, being transparent with whatever's going on for them, with their inside matching their outside and just being able to say, hey, I feel messed up today, or I feel this, or I feel that. It's not a natural thing. It's not what most families do. And so I believe that facilitates the aloneness and the lack of connection, because if you're not being comfortably real, who the heck is connecting with these people who are all looking so happy or whatever they're presenting? Like you start to feel like you don't belong. And so even though that's a part of adolescence, I think it's also when we get to what can you do, my guidance would be get real, like with your kid, just get real. Even if you're a messed up parent, be real about it. And I think authenticity is a big bang for teenagers. Like it really has a payoff, even if it's not perfect. Choose that. What are your thoughts on my little tyranny?
I'm with you. I mean, that was part of Louise's story, that she was raised in North Carolina in the 80s, and she grew up being told racism is over and there's no difference between black and white. And you know, with her own eyes, of course, she very quickly realized racism is not over. Look at the way the black people around me are being treated. And that was like that shattered something in her brain. If they're lying to me about this, if the whole world is lying to me about this, what else are they lying to me about? It could sound like a small thing to some people, like, oh, they were just sugarcoating it as she grew up. But no, this really twisted something for Louise that said, you know, if they're lying about this, what else is going on in this world that I'm not aware of? And that I think felt isolating.
Yeah. What can you trust? Right. When the people that you thought you could trust most, if they'll choose that area, then it kind of rocks your boat around all of it. I get that.
Huh. Rocks the boat. You know, you could feel your worldview kind of shake when you realize that something so big has been told to you in such a different way from reality.
Now, one of the things when we first started this part of the conversation, you were talking about environment. And, you know, we talk about family and the kids. What came to my mind was, where are they finding this stuff anyways? They've got to be introduced to it, you know, and then once they're in, and it blows me away thinking teenagers at school or whatever, wherever that happens, and then they've got to make a decision whether to even do it or not, you know, whether they come from a really great home or a broken home or a challenging one. Where is their education in making these decisions coming from?
And and the information that we give them to make those decisions is just not true. You know, I'm a child of the early 90s who grew up with DARE, drug abuse resistance education, and police officers coming into our classroom saying, you know, if you try cannabis, it's going to fry your brain, and try it once and you're going to be addicted to heroin. And that, you know, left me in environments where drugs were around and experimentation was tempting, where I didn't have any sort of true information. And I don't think that's a good way to go into any situation.
Mm-hmm. And then you're starting again with a lack of trust, because it's us and them. And they're the ones who are making, like, you guys made fun of DARE. You know, I remember that I went through that time period, not as a kid, but as a parent. And yeah, it was like they were just ridiculous. They held no weight.
And kids are smart. They know that. They you know, we knew DARE was ridiculous. And which made, you know, and so the situation around, you know, when you're away from teachers and, you know, it's the weekend and you attempted to experiment, the situation becomes laughable because DARE was laughable.
Right, right. Okay, so let's move in. We've got harm reduction I really want to get into and some of the legal things. Maybe let's start with, shall we start with harm reduction and what it is, really digging in? Because I think there are people who really don't get it. What's the most important thing we need to understand about how it works?
Well, look, first of all, let's acknowledge that people don't get it. And let's acknowledge that that's very understandable, because a lot of harm reduction sounds quite counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. There's no agreed upon definition for harm reduction, but at its core, it's there in the word, you know, let's reduce harm.
Yeah.
So a real common example outside of the drug world is seatbelts. Seatbelts are a form of harm reduction. People wanted to continue driving, even though it's actually statistically an incredibly dangerous activity. But they said, you know, let's implement seatbelts and speed limits to reduce harm. In the context of addiction, usually the easiest example is needle exchange. You know, medical facilities or clinics or community centers, they give out clean syringes so that people who use intravenous drugs are not spreading HIV and hepatitis C. It's acknowledging that people who use drugs are going to continue to use drugs. And that doesn't mean we should leave them to die of AIDS. We should reduce the harm associated with their drug use by distributing clean needles. Other examples are fentanyl test strips, where you can test your drugs for dangerous substances like fentanyl and carfentanil. The best known example in Vancouver is, of course, Insight, the continent's first supervised injection facility, where people can come and bring their drugs to use them under the watchful eye of a nurse instead of in a back alley. There's actually my favorite way of explaining harm reduction. Let's paint two pictures. The first one is without harm reduction. It's a woman, a homeless woman maybe, who's in a back alley somewhere in the downtown east side. And she's found a dirty needle because that's all that's available. And she's using puddle water because she looks homeless and we won't even let her inside a coffee shop to use tap water. And she's really got to rush the shot she's given herself with this dirty needle and this dirty water because she's afraid of police coming in, or she's afraid of men coming into this alley and seeing what she's doing. So she doesn't have time to measure out her drugs. And the equipment is dirty and she's rushing her dose, and she overdoses. Because she's been forced into this really dangerous situation where anything that could provide safety is not available to her. Contrast that picture with Insight, with our supervised injection facility. You walk in, and instead of, you know, some guy leering at you in a back alley, it's a clinical support worker who greets you with a smile. You know, if you're homeless and life is tough, maybe the first smile you've had all day. Mm. And they give you a clean vial of water, and they give you a clean needle in a wrapped package. And that's what you're using instead of a dirty needle and puddle water. And you walk into the IR, the injection room, and instead of having to rush your shot, you know, in this dingy back alley, you get to sit down at a clean table where there's a mirror in front of you and a clean chair, and you can put your stuff down on the table, take your time, go slow, measure out your dose, only doing what is safe. And then as you do your shot, with fentanyl, of course, there's a risk of overdose, a high risk of overdose these days. Instead of, you know, again, sticking with his example, you know, a guy in an alley who could take advantage of you if you pass out, it's a female nurse who's got her hand on your shoulder and is really looking out for you. And it's going to mm-hmm. take care of you if you do overdose and respond and save your life if that happens. I just think if you look at those two pictures and keep those two pictures in your mind and compare one to the other, it becomes pretty tough to say that harm reduction is not a good thing. I understand how you can oppose to it on ideological grounds. If you want to say, I just don't like helping people who use drugs, that's fair and that's your opinion. But I think it becomes tough to say that harm reduction is a bad thing when you compare those two pictures to each other.
And isn't the misconception that it leads to more drug usage also incorrect? It actually leads to less.
Right, of course. Yeah, I forgot about that. And I started my little speech there saying that harm reduction can sound counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But counterintuitive because the academic research is behind harm reduction. I mean, mountains of it. Most of it coming out of Vancouver, actually. But I get that it's counterintuitive. How do you minimize drug use by giving someone a needle and a clean place to inject? I get the idea, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, we can acknowledge that harm reduction can sound scary. But what they found when Insight opened was that overdoses decreased in the neighborhood because they were happening inside Insight, and applications for treatment facilities in the neighborhood increased.
Right.
Because Insight is a healthcare facility. It offers a gateway to the healthcare system.
Right.
So yes, you can inject drugs at Insight and go on, you know, ignore everybody and go on with your day. But you can also, you know, if you're having a really hard day and you feel like you're tired and you finally want to get out of this life, you can ask that nurse, you got a phone number for a treatment facility? I'm done with this. And that's what happens at Insight every single day.
Yeah.
This supervised injection facility helps people stop using drugs.
Well, they feel safe, right? Finally. And so they can ask for help. Asking for help is a hard thing to do, especially when we haven't talked about this, when the response to an addict asking for help or from a hospital has so much reactivity. I mean, people are treated so badly. So here they're not, right? So the person feels a bit of respect and being seen as a person, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that begins in our legal definition of drugs. If you are using drugs, by definition in our society, you are a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we associate all sorts of nasty things with the idea of a criminal. And inflicting that sort of stigma on someone can make it very difficult for that person to ask for help.
So if I may throw something in there, because I saw that Dr. Carl Hart actually said some nice words about you and your book. And I had the pleasure of seeing him speak in Vancouver about responsible drug use. And he was speaking about adults. One of his suggestions for harm reduction was about decriminalization, and that, you know, helps reduce the stigma. But what are your thoughts in regards to what he talks about, clean source and have accessibly clean so that people, you know, they know what they're getting?
Oops. Oh. Did we all freeze? Just Mark.
No, I can hear you, Tasha.
Oh, okay. There, your picture.
No, there you go.
Set, but we're good.
Strange. Oh, there we go.
We're back. I can see you guys again. Yeah, no, I got the question.
Okay, great.
Dr. Carl Hart is a prestigious professor at Columbia University, you know, one of the most, one of the best educational institutions in the United States, in New York City. And with his latest book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, this professor at Columbia came out and said, I use heroin. Wow, right?
Mm-hmm.
He really went out on a limb there. You know, he put his career on the line. But he said, I am a celebrated professor who does talks around the world and teaches at one of the best schools on the planet. And I occasionally use heroin, and it is not problematic for me. And this is something that a lot of people do. And it's about time we start talking about that. And that led into I think that led into a lot of his ideas about some of the topics that you alluded to, legalization, clean sources of drugs. Because if you have a professor at Columbia who wants to occasionally use heroin, you know, that person is worth keeping alive. And of course, every drug user is worth keeping alive. So we should give them safer ways to do what they're doing. And Vancouver's starting to experiment with that. I'll pause here for a second and define decriminalization versus legalization, because I think that it's very common to get these two things confused. Decriminalization is removing criminal penalties for illegal drugs. So if you're caught with heroin on the street, you're no longer going to go to jail. Maybe you'll get a fine. Maybe you'll get nothing. But that's what decriminalization does. It just removes the legal penalty. Legalization and regulation takes decriminalization and then goes a step further. It says not only are we going to drop criminal penalties for drugs, but we're also going to bring these substances under the control of government. We're going to take them out of the dealer's hands And we're going to find a way to regulate them and provide them to you safely in ways that are pure. Of course, the obvious example is tobacco or alcohol. Legalization and regulation would be complicated. I think that we have to acknowledge that. You know, I don't know if we want Pfizer supplying cocaine. They don't really have a great track record with that sort of thing. So there's going to be tough questions with legalization. But I think it's time that we start asking those questions, because fentanyl has all but replaced heroin in Vancouver. It is a very dangerous drug that is killing a lot of people, 2,000 people a year now, which is just incredible. And I think that legalization and regulation and, you know, what Dr. Carl Hart calls safe supply is a way that we could begin to minimize those deaths.
Can we also talk about pharmaceutical companies and how they did flood the market and how the fentanyl then got in, and just give us, our listeners, an overview of all that?
Yeah, this overdose crisis began a long time ago now. It began about 20 years ago, the effects of what we're seeing now. And it began with prescription pills, and it began with pharmaceutical companies like Purdue Pharma, but also more mainstream corporations like Walgreens in the United States, in distributing the drugs. They really made it, they really pushed these opiate painkillers, Oxycontin being the best known. They pushed them on doctors to prescribe them more. They told them that they weren't as addictive as other opiates, and they flooded the market. Eventually, doctors figured out their mistakes and really cut back on prescribing these addictive substances, Oxycontin. But there was a big unintended consequence there. By now, a lot of people were addicted. And when doctors scaled back their prescriptions, they didn't just stop using, they were addicted. They went looking for another source of opiates. And that's where dealers were all too happy to find them on the streets with heroin. This drug's a lot stronger, and it's 1/10 the price. You want to try this? Mm-hmm. So from prescription pills, this opiate epidemic moved to heroin through the 2000s, 2010s. We're now in its third wave, its third stage of the overdose crisis. And now we moved on from prescription pills to heroin to synthetic opiates like fentanyl and carfentanil. And these have entered the market because they are cheap. Fentanyl is a lot cheaper than heroin to produce and to transport. And this is simple economics. You know, dealers don't want to kill their buyers. That's bad. That's bad business. Mm-hmm. But fentanyl is so cheap to manufacture and transport that people can die all day and they'll still make more money.
Where is it coming from? How did it
depends
get
where you are. Most of Canada's fentanyl is either homebrewed or comes from China. Often now the precursor chemicals come from China, and they send them in the mail to Canada, and the stuff is made here. If you're in the United States, something similar is happening, but there's a stop in Mexico where the drugs are going through. I'll kind of take on a controversial view here, though, and start with the pharmaceutical companies. I don't put nearly as much blame on them as most people in this conversation do. And it's the same with heroin and fentanyl with the dealers. People are hurting. And if it wasn't the pharmaceutical companies and then the dealers, it would have been something else. People are hurting and they're looking for something to alleviate that pain. While we've seen opiate use go up and blame the pharmaceutical companies, we've also seen the use of meth and methamphetamines skyrocket at the same similar rates. And that's not coming from pharmaceutical companies. So people are looking to relieve their pain and they're finding illegal drugs because that's, you know, again, we don't have a great mental health care system who can you know, help them through, you know, quote unquote, legitimate methods. So instead of the pharmaceutical companies, instead of the dealers, I'd really like us talking more about economic inequality, you know, and about how, you know, the American dream is no longer promised to everybody. Where you are born on this continent is hugely indicative of the kind of life you will have, right? We're no longer starting with equal opportunities. And I think that's the sort of conversation should begin to be having when we're talking about blame for the overdose crisis.
Mm-hmm. So what's a step? What's the social movement that needs to happen, and hopefully involving also drug users, everybody, that everyone could be active in? What is that movement? As you say, if we take this piece around economics, because I think it is super important.
First, we got to start reducing stigma. We got to change the way that we talk about people who use drugs. And I don't think that we can do that until, you know, as Mark suggested, we begin with decriminalization. I don't think that, you know, our brains can begin to really transition how we talk about drug use until we stop, by definition, categorizing these people as criminals. And reducing stigma will save lives. You know, somebody who was previously, you know, hiding alone in their basement, you know, hiding their drug use from their parents or their wife, will be more encouraged to speak openly about their addiction issue. You know, I'm no longer a criminal. I can ask for help with this. It'll bring people out of the shadows. You know, they won't feel like they have to inject alone in a back alley, hiding everything.
Just like with mental health, right? Mental health for a long time, no one talked about. Now people are talking about it. So
we finally started that one.
Yeah.
Well, so that's where the conversation's got to begin.
Yeah, you really painted a picture for me when you described the woman in the alley and then talking about, you know, the addiction not having, responding to negativity. And it really moved me at that point that it asked me, you know, what more can I do? What can we do? And that's what I like about the question you asked, Tasha, is like, how do we, you know, and I think the safe space you were talking about, what more can we do?
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you where all these ideas came from for me. I was working as a general assignment reporter at the Georgia Strait newspaper in Vancouver. And one of the stories I was assigned, or maybe I found it myself, I don't remember, was to write about an experimental clinic in Vancouver called Crosstown Clinic that gives people who have been addicted to drugs for a long time, gives them diacetylmorphine. That's the medical name for heroin. So this small group of experimental patients is being given pure medical grade heroin in Vancouver. And I did that article. And then a year later, I did another article. And then a couple of years later, I checked back in with them, did another article. And I've been meeting with these same patients for 5, 6, 7 years now. And the difference that I've seen in their lives is just incredible. Most of them are still using heroin, diacetylmorphine. They're still struggling with, you know, terrible things that have happened in their past. But most of them, the vast majority, are no longer homeless. The vast majority are no longer living in absolute poverty. The majority of them are not breaking car windows and stealing to feed their habits and that sort of thing. Because we've removed, we've taken them out of the hustle. You know, it's the hustle. We've given them a safe space where they're interacting with nurses. We've provided complementary services such as housing support. What we've actually done with all of that is remove incentives for using drugs. We've taken stress out of their life. We've taken hardship out of their life. We've given them, by giving them heroin, believe it or not, we've given them fewer reasons to use drugs. And this is actually in the data at Crosstown Clinic. You know, you would think anybody who's given being given free medical grade heroin is going to just want more and more and more and ask for a higher dose. That's not what's happened at Crosstown. These patients over years have said, okay, I'm feeling better now. Can you lower my dose? I want less free heroin. And that's happened with the vast majority of patients because we've given them fewer reasons to use drugs. I'll tell you the most amazing and simple statistic. The women at Crosstown Clinic, a relatively high percentage of them entered the program as sex workers, people who were forced to sell their body to feed these awful addictions to heroin. The percentage that has stopped with that activity, this percentage that has moved out of sex work, is 100%.
Wow.
I mean, that's an amazing, 100 is an incredible statistic. And I mean, that alone, I think, means it's worth having a conversation about prescription heroin, legalization and regulation.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest obstacle to this becoming reality?
A big part of it is the public. This is not a program that the majority of the public is on side with.
Right.
You know, the war on drugs has gained a lot of critics over the last 20 years, but mainstream society, the majority of the general public and the politicians they elect, does not believe that we should be implementing this sort of program at a wide scale.
Right.
Because they don't understand addiction, because they don't understand that these people are not just criminals, that they're, you know, they're struggling with mental health issues and trauma, and we need to find a better way to treat them. Mm-hmm. So what do we got to do? Education. That's the word. InSight, our first injection site in Vancouver, was not an easy thing to do. You know, that took 10 concerted years of activism and education and public speaking engagements and Q&As at City Hall. What we got to do here is education.
And I think blow up this idea that success is defined by abstinence, period.
Absolutely.
Because, like that one, your back's against the wall because it's like this vicious circle. You're trying to get relief from pain. And then basically the only way to do that is take away the one thing that's soothing the pain.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a success.
Or Mark brought up the example of Dr. Carl Hart. He had a tough childhood, but he's not dealing with the sort of severe trauma that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And he's using drugs recreationally. And he asks, what right do you have to tell me to stop? And stop and think about that for a minute. Like, wait a second, what right do we have to tell you to stop? Or kind of flip the question. What right do we have to create a situation where you do not know what you're injecting into your body? On the street, you don't know what you're doing. Maybe it's fentanyl. Maybe it's Xanax. That's a big problem these days. You're finding Xanax in heroin and being knocked unconscious the second you inject. A big part of these questions around addiction and legalization and that sort of thing is autonomy, giving people, women especially, autonomy over their own bodies. So like, what right do we have to tell you to stop? What right do we have to tell you that you're not going to know what you put into your body?
Right. And how's the pandemic fitting in with all this?
Horribly. Yeah. The pandemic has badly exacerbated the overdose crisis. Vancouver was making progress. We'd actually brought deaths down through 2019. When COVID hit, they shot right back up and we're at an all-time high now. I'll give you two numbers. Through the 2010s, from the year 2001 to 2010, the average number of annual overdose deaths in British Columbia was 204. For that entire period, we had 204 deaths per year. Last year, we had 2,000. So we've seen a tenfold increase, the result of this overdose crisis, and then its exacerbation by COVID. I mean, and that's a tenfold increase. That's a lot of people dying.
So if we had a friend who was struggling or a family member, what would be your guidance around offering support? What do you think the most supportive thing we could do is?
Yeah, again, I mean, this is a tough question and there's no right answer. There are some wrong answers, but there's no right answer. And there's no easy answer either. I think what we got to start with is love, is give them love. Tell them, I don't like what you're doing, but you're safe here with me. And I don't like what you're doing, but I want to keep talking to you. And I don't like what you're doing, but, you know, I don't want to kick you out on the street. And when you're ready, I'd really love to help you with treatment. If that's your choice, like you said, you know, not everybody is ready to quit drugs. Not everybody wants to quit drugs. And I think we need to begin to start talking about how it's not our right to tell them that that's not okay.
Right. So you've got a live Zoom event coming up. Tell us about that so people who want to hear some more can tune in for that.
Yeah, we're still pinning down a date, but it's going to happen probably during the first couple of weeks of February. You can easily find information online. My Twitter stream is where most of this stuff happens, twitter.com/tlupic. That's an event that we're going to have talking about the book, obviously. But what's really special about this one is I'm going to be joined by Jess Tilley, one of the book's main protagonists from Massachusetts. So Jess is going to be there to answer questions alongside me. She'll be able to recount, you know, her history with addiction, her history with drug user organizing and activism in Massachusetts. And now, you know, she'll talk about what she's doing at the national level, you know, how she's bringing these ideas to Washington, which is, you know, incredible. Jess is one of the most incredible women people I've ever met in my entire life. And so it's going to be really cool. Yeah. She's one of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life. I mean, I'm so happy to know her, and I'm just feel so privileged to have been given the trust to tell her story in this book. So I'm really excited about having her there for this next event.
And so when is that going to be? You said you don't have an exact date yet, but they can find out on your Twitter feed.
Yeah, it'll be the first couple of weeks of February. We're pinning down a host and getting the venue organized and that sort of thing. But the best place for all this information is my Twitter feed or Facebook. It's twitter.com or facebook.com/tlupick, LUPICK.
And Mark will put those links on.
Mark already has those links on Conscious Living Radio. It's on our YouTube channel and it's on the Facebook in the description of this video. Right. So there's all the information there where you can reach out to Travis and his work.
I think too, if I may, the one thing about Jess and Louise, they got involved in the activism, like the meaning that so many people suffer because of lack of meaning in their lives. And this is not just about addiction. Everybody need some sort of meaning or you drift off, right? And so for these folks who are struggling, like reading their story, it just struck me how that piece came into effect. They were doing something to help others. And that changes everything. Like it changes your sense of yourself when you actually reach out and stand for what you think it needs to happen, what's right, what you see is right.
They have found their mission. You know, they have found their life's mission. Work.
And so have you. So have you, it looks like.
I mean, I just talk to these people on the phone and write down their words. I mean, what they're accomplishing is incredible.
Yeah. Don't throw the compliment away there, Travis. I think you too are doing a lot. And by putting both these books out there and doing these kinds of interviews, you're helping educate people. And I really am thankful. So appreciate
you. And thank you guys so much for having me.
Okay, well, that's it for us for today. Thanks for joining us. Conscious Living Radio, 100.5 FM on Wednesday nights, 6 to 7. And then go ahead, Mark, do the other places.
Well, we're now, you know, with the change in the world the past couple of years, where you've got our YouTube channel up and going. So if you watch us on YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe. And you can always follow us on Facebook as well. So visit consciouslivingradio.org. The information's there. And we're just happy to share Travis's work with the world because it's so important right now. So thank you, Travis.
Thanks, you guys,
everybody.
Again.
Okay, bye.
You are listening to CFRO Community Radio Station. The upcoming show, Conscious Living Radio, is a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation.
I don't wanna tell my mom I smoke this weed. I don't wanna tell my dad he'll call me weak. I don't wanna be the blackest of the sheep, missing their call every single week. I don't wanna say. Sometimes I do drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Drugs, can't find us. If you think I'm gone, I'm just doing drugs, not hard ones. Just ones that change my mind up. Don't mind me if I light up. Only need it sort of, kind of drugs. La 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 da da. La 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 da da. Drugs. La 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 da da. La 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 da da. Sometimes I don't care. Sometimes I cry too. Sometimes life's a little hard to get used to. Occasionally I forget to sleep. Remind myself that I gotta eat 3 times a day this week. Try not to clench my teeth. Got a little OCD. Listen to the CDC when I'm feeling uneasy. Sometimes I do drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Drugs, can't find us. If you think I'm gone, I'm just doing drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Don't mind me if I light up. Only need it sort of, kinda drugs. Sometimes I do drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Drugs, can't find us. If you think I'm gone, I'm just doing drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Don't mind me if I light up, only need a soda.
Sometimes I do drugs, not hard ones, just ones that change my mind up. Drugs, can't find us.
If you think I'm gone, I'm just doing drugs. Not hard ones, just ones that